This is your Polycast for Tuesday, April 4th, your daily check-in on Minnesota politics. I'm Mike Mulcahy in the Minnesota Public Radio newsroom. On today's edition, long debates over protests and taxes at the Capitol, and the legislature gets involved in a dispute over a golf course at a state park. After a passionate debate, the Minnesota House refused to back away from a proposal to stiffen penalties for obstructing freeways and other routes during protests. The Republican-led chamber defeated efforts last night to strip the measure from a broader public safety bill. It would elevate certain public nuisance crimes to a gross misdemeanor, which could mean bigger fines and time behind bars. Republican Representative Nick Zerwas of Elk River supports the measure.
If you're on the freeway, if you're blocking an airport, if you're blocking a train, you deserve to go to jail. It's just that simple.
Republicans argued that while it's already illegal to block a freeway, current penalties aren't stopping protests from getting out of hand. But DFL Representative Dave Pinto of St. Paul said the possible penalty for blockades during a protest would be stiffer than for some domestic assault cases.
This is being pushed as part of a systemic agenda, nationally and certainly in our state, to suppress dissent. And I just want to end with a final question. Aren't you folks supported by the Tea Party? The Tea Party was an illegal protest.
The protest provision is part of a broader public safety budget bill that still needs to be negotiated with the Senate and Governor Dayton. The Minnesota Senate has passed a $900 million package of tax cuts that includes a reduction in the lowest income bracket to 5%. Senators voted 40-27 Monday for the bill that also reduces taxes on Social Security income and business property taxes. Republican Senator Roger Chamberlain of Lino Lakes, the chair of the Senate Tax Committee, said the goal of the bill was to empower people and not the state.
We were not looking to reform the entire system. We did focus on a few things. Simplicity, fairness, predictability, and sustainability of the tax system. To the extent that we could impact those things, we did that in everything we addressed during the last 3 months.
The Senate bill also provides tax breaks to farmers paying for school district bond levies and to college graduates paying off student loans. But most of the debate centered on a new tax credit for people who donate to entities that provide private school scholarships. Supporters contend the provision will give low-income families more options and help close achievement gaps. But critics argue it would undermine public schools. DFL Senator Jason Isaacson of Shoreview said Republicans were giving rich people a tax break, not helping schools.
Poor people aren't going to be taking advantage of this tax credit. So you found a way to funnel money around the government to make sure that we're still putting money into private schools. That is unacceptable to me.
The Senate tax bill also has to be negotiated with the House and the governor. Minnesota's two U.S. senators voted against sending the nomination of Judge Neil Gorsuch to the U.S. Supreme Court to the Senate floor. Despite their and other Democrats' opposition yesterday, the Senate Judiciary Committee approved the nomination. During the hearing, Senator Amy Klobuchar said that Gorsuch has repeatedly gone beyond the facts in cases to write broad ideological opinions. She brought up campaign finance reform.
And above all, we need justices who understand and will uphold the motto on the Supreme Court building to help all Americans achieve equal justice under law. That's why I will not be supporting Judge Gorsuch's nomination to be an associate justice of the Supreme Court.
When it was his turn, Senator Al Franken said Gorsuch isn't a consensus builder.
In the absence of answers, we have to rely on his record, and his record is not reassuring during his time on the Tenth Circuit. Judge Gorsuch has consistently ruled in favor of powerful interests. He sided with corporations over workers, corporations over consumers.
The Judiciary Committee sent the nomination to the full Senate on a party-line vote. Farms get much of the blame for the phosphorus, nitrogen, and other nutrients that end up in lakes and rivers, creating conditions ripe for toxic algae blooms. But in the Twin Cities, it turns out the primary source hits much closer to home. Kirsty Marone reports.
A study out today from the University of Minnesota is the first comprehensive look at not only how the nutrients are getting into our urban watershed, but how long they're staying. The study focused on seven sub-watersheds of the Mississippi River around St. Paul. The conclusion? The leading source of nitrogen in the watersheds is household lawn fertilizer. Its use amounts to 10 times more than commercial fertilizers used on golf courses and college campuses. For phosphorus, the biggest culprit is pet waste. Sarah Hobby is a professor in the university's Department of Ecology, Evolution, and Behavior. She says her research team found that urban watersheds don't hold on to nutrients for long.
Because there's such a dense network of streets, it's really easy for phosphorus to get moved into streets. Once that phosphorus is in the street, there's nothing to hold on to it. And so it's just readily washed into the storm drain system and into our surface waters, unless there's some kind of a storm drain pond or something that's going to trap that phosphorus before it moves downstream.
Hobby says much of the phosphorus and nitrogen getting into the streets likely is coming from falling tree leaves and snow melting off people's yards. She says rain gardens and more frequent street sweeping can help keep those nutrients out of storm drains. And she says people can do their part by reducing excessive use of yard fertilizer and cleaning up after their pets.
People are generally pretty good about picking up after their dogs when they take their dogs for walks, but maybe they get a little lax when it comes to picking up, you know, dog waste in the backyard, especially when it's cold outside.
The study will be published this week in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. Kirstie Marone, Minnesota Public Radio News, Collegeville.
Some folks in southern Minnesota farm country are taking a gamble on a golf course. It's one of the last in a Minnesota state park. The Department of Natural Resources was ready to shut it down until a determined group of local residents fought back. Brian Baxt has more.
The smell of manure from a nearby farm wafts in as Randy Krasmarczyk walks me down the seventh fairway at Fort Ridgely State Park. There's an eagle circling high above the Minnesota River Valley. Tall prairie grass rustles in the stout wind where wildflowers bloom in the summer.
It all comes together out here.
Krasmarczyk grows corn and soybeans on land near Sleepy Eye that has been in his family since 1896. The new grandfather is fond of Fort Ridgely and its golf course, where he's been coming since he was a kid.
You look over here and you can see the river valley, and you look over, well, on the other side is the cemetery. There's actually, there over there.
Yes, a cemetery. After all, Fort Ridgely was a Civil War-era Army outpost. The nine-hole golf course came later. It wends around the old stone fort and other landmarks where they've coexisted for 90 years. That's why Krasmarczyk and the Friends of Fort Ridgely group he belongs to took a gut punch when DNR officials delivered a message last spring.
Pretty much shocked us when they announced they were closing the golf course. There really hadn't been any, you know, hints that that was coming.
The message was that the course no longer fit with the DNR strategic mission or demands by lawmakers that the agency stretch its dollars further. The trend lines weren't promising either. The number of rounds played has dropped steadily, and the gap between expenses and revenue has widened. Parks and Trails Division Deputy Director Philip Leversedge explained the decision to state lawmakers recently.
And the high operating cost of Fort Ridgely and the low level of use caused us to start to rethink its future.
The plan was to plant the course over with native vegetation, to upgrade camping facilities, and to highlight the park's horseback riding instead. But the park's loyalists came up with an offer. They'd partner with the nearby city of Fairfax and take over the golf course. City Administrator Marcia Siebert-Voles says it's a tourism draw and important to the small town's economic vitality. And she says people are concerned that if the golf course goes away, the park itself would wither.
We're afraid because they've already, you know, cut back on maintenance issues and stuff out in the park that we don't want that to occur where it's just a huge wayside rest.
But talks bogged down, and the DNR moved ahead with the closure. Mentions of golf were stripped from the park's signs. White-top stakes were hammered into the ground where sprinkler heads would be dug up. Undeterred, the local contingent enlisted Republican Representative Tim Miller and other area legislators. They advanced bills forcing the DNR to negotiate a low-cost lease, an alcohol license, and other accommodations. The measure wound up this spring in big budget bills vital to DNR operations. And Miller says, suddenly, negotiations intensified over a five-year plan to keep the course open.
By no means do we want to strong-arm the DNR. I believe that we needed to kind of show them that we were serious.
There hasn't been much resistance in the legislature, but DFL Senator Kerry Dietzick of Minneapolis is raising concerns about whether a Fort Ridgely deal would be consistent with an operating agreement her city has to run the Fort Snelling Golf Course.
I don't think it's fair to my taxpayers if they are paying a higher or different rate than someplace else, just like someplace else shouldn't pay higher than Minneapolis. So
the Fort Ridgely course is hilly. The drop-off from the first tee box is so steep it doubles as a sledding hill. Some suspect the terrain might explain the trouble attracting more golf patrons. Motorized golf carts haven't been allowed, but local boosters are hoping they will be after an archaeological review. The DNR isn't commenting on negotiations, other than to say things have been progressing well and no contract is final. Chris Marzik realizes the hard work has just begun.
I've said to friends here quite a bit the last few weeks, we're now the dog that caught the car, and what are we going to do with it?
A deal with the DNR could be signed as soon as this week. If it is, the scramble will be on to get the golf course in shape for a May reopening. Covering politics, I'm Brian Baxt in Fairfax.
And that's your Polycast. For this Tuesday, your daily check-in on Minnesota politics, I'm Mike Mulcahy in the Minnesota Public Radio newsroom.